This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, composer John Zorn, turned 60 last Monday. His birthday is being celebrated with an ongoing festival of concerts in Europe and the Americas, including a day-long celebration at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, September 28th. Zorn has a prolific and wide-ranging body of work, encompassing jazz improvisation, rock and metal, chamber music, and orchestral works. He's also important for releasing recordings of experimental music by other musicians on his record label Zadok. Zadok is a Hebrew word for a righteous man or spiritual leader. Terry spoke to John Zorn last Tuesday. Zorn's compositions have been recorded by many groups, including his own. But even with his own groups, sometimes he doesn't play his saxophone, but just conducts. That's the case on his latest album, Dream Machines. From that album, this is his composition, The Conqueror Worm.
John Zorn, welcome to Fresh Air. Happy birthday. Happy 60th.
Thank you.
So we just heard The Conqueror Worm, and I'm wondering, is that inspired by the Edgar Allan Poe poem? Is it inspired by another composition that exists of the same name? Is it inspired by the movie, the English movie, The Witchfinder General, and the English version? The American version of the movie was called The Conqueror Worm, or is it none of the above?
Well, let's say all of the above and none of the above. I guess the title came from the Vincent Price movie you were talking about, which I love so much. Somehow in my imagination, it connected up with Brian Gyson, and the CD Dream Machines is all somehow revolves around the work of William Burroughs and Brian Gyson. So I wrote this very complicated piece. We went into the studio, and as you know on the record, there's a variety of different kinds of music that this band performs, and they're amazing musicians. But The Conqueror Worm ended up being a piece that was just so difficult to play, we couldn't really get it in the studio satisfactorily enough. So I put it aside. We recorded the rest of the music, and the CD was a little bit short. It was like 30-some-odd minutes, 38 or something. I needed one more piece. So I actually said, hey, guys, I'm just going to, you know, go into the studio and write a new piece. So take like a 10-minute break.
Wow.
And I wrote that piece in the studio in like 5 or 10 minutes. It just popped right out. And we recorded it. We did a couple of takes, and it was nailed. And it is one of the best pieces on the record. I think it's really slamming. It really gives everybody a chance to stretch out. And that happens sometimes, that kind of magic.
And it's kind of film noirish, and I know you like film noir a lot.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Well, it has a mood, a nice mood.
So there's a lot of celebrations that have been going on of your music for the past few months and that are going to continue because it's your 60th birthday. What does turning 60 mean to you?
There are no more doubts.
What does that mean?
It means
when
that
little
guy,
that?
That little guy that sits on my shoulder,
yeah,
you know, the guy in the red suit with the pitchfork and the pointed ears and the tail, mm-hmm. That little guy that's on your shoulder that once in a while used to whisper in your ear, you know, you could be really wrong about this. That guy's not around anymore. I brushed him off. Everything is very clear. what I need to do, why I'm on the planet, the best way to accomplish it, what is a distraction, what helps me focus. Everything is really there. And I feel like people have always said I'm very prolific and I work very hard. I work all the time. I'm not really interested in vacations or getting away from my work. But I've gotten more and more prolific. It's at this point, it's like turning on a tap, or it's like plugging into an energy source and staying plugged in. I used to think that composition was a matter of problem solving, where you set yourself a certain number of problems, you have a certain set of limitations, there are parameters that you deal with, and then you solve those problems and a piece comes out of it. Now there are no more solutions because there are no more problems. I just turn the tap and the music comes pouring out.
So you've done a lot of music that relates to being Jewish. You have a series of albums called Radical Jewish Culture. You have, your record label is called Zadik, which means a righteous person. So what is the Jewish music that you were actually exposed to when you were young, and what's the Jewish music that you investigated when you became more deeply interested in it?
Well, my parents were not outwardly Jewish. They came out of a generation where being a Jew was not only a disadvantage, it was a death sentence. And they escaped all of that, and we celebrated Christmas. We didn't have Jewish music in the house.
Did they grow up in America?
My mother's born in the Bronx. My father was born in the old country and moved to Astoria, Queens when he was about 6 years old.
Did they lose family in the Holocaust?
Yeah. There were such problems. But I think they found it difficult to understand why I wanted to reconnect with being Jewish. My father literally said to me, "Hey man, I gave you a way out of this because I went to a Protestant church when I was growing up." And that was a little confusing.
Why did they do that?
Well, they were trying to help me. They were trying to save me from what they thought was a disadvantage.
Your music is very unconventional, but when you were growing up Jewish in a Jewish neighborhood, but your parents sent you to a Protestant church and wanted to give you a way out of Judaism, did you wish at that time to be more conventional and to be more like your friends who were Jewish and weren't going to church?
I was always an outsider, proud of being an outsider. I always reveled in the outsiders. I'm not sure why that is. I was born in 53, and I think one of the first movie experiences I had was going to see Ben-Hur. Came out in 59. And back then, you know, movie theaters were big, beautiful wonderlands, you know.
Yeah.
And made even more huge by the fact that I was so small. I was only, you know, a couple feet high, this little six-year-old. And my parents took me to see Ben-Hur. And on the way home, long movie, I was in my parents' Pontiac, and I would always sit in the back seat. And I was really tired, and I fell asleep. And when I woke up, I was alone. The car had been parked on the street. The doors were locked. The windows were rolled up. I'm sure everybody out there is, like, shocked, but maybe that wasn't such an unusual thing. Maybe they just didn't want to wake me up. I don't know what it was, but I was alone. And I was six, got out of the car, locked the door, closed it, wandered over to my parents' house, buzzed the buzzer, and my mother came to the door. I'll never forget the look on her face. It was not one of shock or humiliation or feeling guilty. She thought it was the funniest thing she ever saw in her life. She started laughing, and she called my father. She said, Henry, come and look at this. I said, "Did you forget something in the car?" Oh, that was just the funniest thing she ever heard. And I remember thinking, I'm going to have to take care of myself for the rest of my life. I can't trust these people.
Well, you think they accidentally, think they forgot about you and that they left you?
I don't know. They might have forgotten. They might have started arguing. They argued a lot. I mean, there were a lot of things going on back then, you know. It's not for me to make a value judgment, but all I can do is say for myself what it did was it created a feeling of independence.
Well, that story about being locked in a car, alone, happens after you go to see Ben-Hur. And there's that really famous chariot race scene where like a wheel comes off of one of the chariots, right?
Yeah.
And like when you're a kid, seeing something like that on a big screen could be like absolutely gripping and also terrifying. Did that affect your experience of being alone in the car?
I don't think so. I don't feel a connection. I mean, I can tell you that I watch Ben-Hur a lot. I mean, sometimes I have it on repeat play. I was watching it just last night. So, you know, when I write music, I don't like to write in silence. I like to have something going on behind me. I don't really watch Ben-Hur. It's on in the other room, and I'm sitting in my workroom, and I can hear it. And it kind of makes me feel like I'm not alone. I'm in the house. There's someone there. There's, you know, it's very familiar. I've seen the movie hundreds of times, literally hundreds, not 100, like 200-300 times. Sometimes it's like on, it just plays 5-6 times a day.
I don't remember the score from Ben-Hur. Is it good?
Brilliant. Nicholas Rocha, brilliant.
Oh, okay. I should go back and listen to that.
Oh, fabulous music.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with composer John Zorn. He turned 60 last Monday, and there's an ongoing festival of concerts of his work in the Americas and Europe, including a day-long celebration at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, September 28th. Before all this global recognition, he was known as a major figure in New York's downtown experimental music scene. Here's one of John Zorn's groups, Masada, with a song called Malkut.
Was the John Zorn group Masada, and the composition was called Malkut. I want to tell you one of the things I really like about this, and you could tell me if what I'm hearing is anything close to what you're doing. So it's kind of going back and forth between a Yiddish-sounding melody and Für Elise, the Beethoven composition that so many people know because when they took piano lessons as a child, as I did, you're taught to play it. Is that happening in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely, that's happening. But what it means is,
yeah, go ahead.
You know, whatever you think it means is what it means.
Well, what I'm hearing is
I don't have any deep agenda here.
That you're finding this kind of musical connection between Beethoven and a style of Jewish music.
You could put it that way, or it could be something entirely other. This was, you could say, a musical etude, a way of putting disparate elements, elements of music that maybe don't belong together, together in some way. These compositions from the first book of Masada were written in 93, 4, 5, 6, at the beginning of my kind of Jewish awakening. And it was written at a time when composition was problem-solving for me. It was a matter of really setting myself a different musical issues and problems and trying to solve them.
Did you study classical music when you were young?
Yeah. I started with Leonardo Bellato. He's a very great composer, lives in Barcelona. We're still in touch. I'd been already improvising on the piano, and I'd been improvising on the guitar. I played flute, I played clarinet, I played bass, I played guitar, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, I studied classical and also was turned on to jazz. I listened to rock. I listened to soul. I mean, growing up in the 60s in New York, you listened to everything. Salsa was exploding. I mean,
how did you feel about the studying technique part of learning music? Practicing.
Well, I mean, discipline is a very important thing. I wanted to play the bass, and my parents said, you know, you don't want to play the bass. That's in the background. You want to play the guitar. That's in the front, you know. They got me a little guitar. Then they had a teacher come by who was very strict and very disciplined and had me spend all my time playing scales. And he wanted me to play the chromatic scale, four octaves, from the lowest note to the highest note of the guitar and back down in 8 seconds. And I worked on that a lot, but I couldn't get it any lower than 12. And he said, until you can get it at 8 seconds, I won't let you play a Beatles tune or anything like that. You have to do this. So I told him to go get stuffed. And I started doing my own thing. Discipline is important as long as you're having a good time. What I always did was I did what I enjoyed. And I think that's why I don't have any gray hairs. I'm 60, but I look like I'm 40. Every day is a vacation, but every day is a work day. I don't want to take vacations, because music is my life, and if I escape from music, that's the same thing as death. So a vacation is death to me. Sitting on the beach for a week is my idea of hell. That would kill me.
Why is that your idea of hell?
Well, I mean, I want to make music.
You could make music on the beach?
I couldn't make music on the beach. I make music in my home, and I'll tell you what my home is. My home is not just an apartment. I've been living in the same place for 38 years. My home is a device, a device for enabling creativity, a device for cutting out everything that the chaos outside that people think is reality. That's chaos. My home is a way of insulating myself and stripping all that away so I can get into what reality is for me.
So describe
creativity. My home is a device.
Describe it, though. What's in it that makes it a device?
Books, records, art.
Instruments? What do you have?
I have a saxophone, but I don't, you know, pick it up unless I got to take it to a gig. It's sitting in the corner, and I don't go near it. But I have a little a work room that's very small. Maybe it's 8 feet square, something like that, 7 feet square. And it's wall-to-wall books and CDs, records. And there's a small little children's desk that I've had since I was a kid. It's a Stickley original, beautiful Gustav Stickley. All my furniture Stickley that I got from my grandparents. I have a little rocking chair that I've sat in since I was like, you know, 8 years old. And I sit in the same chair at the same desk. And that's where I write music.
Wait a minute. So you're on a child's rocking chair and a child's desk when you're composing?
Yeah.
That is odd. You have to agree.
It's no judgments, Terry.
Okay.
No judgments.
<Very good>. But are they, it's just, are they child
well,
size
I said
or did you just have them as a child?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you're thinking when I say children's desk. The desk is probably about 3 feet, you know, high, and the chair, the little rocker is maybe, you know, foot and a half, 2 feet. But I sit cross-legged on the rocker. I don't really have much other furniture. I sleep on the floor on a futon.
You sleep on, oh, wow.
Yeah, I remember when Fred Kaplan, who wrote for The New Yorker, came into my house. He wrote a big piece in the New Yorker, and I was very upset at what he wrote. I mean, I think he meant well, and everybody thought it was an interesting piece. And he, when I challenged him with it, he would say, "Hey, I made you into an interesting character, you know?" I said, you know, well, basically what he was responding to is, "Hey, what is this nut? He has no furniture. Hey, his clothes are in a little cardboard box in the corner." Like, well, you know, you can say, yes, that's unusual, but it's not unusual for me. This is how I live because I have my priorities straight. You could put it this way. If I dressed in a monk's habit, maybe you would understand it a little bit better.
Is that how you feel, like an ascetic who has renounced many things except for, in your case, music?
Well, anything that gets in the way of creativity gets cut out. You know, I live a very, very serious existence. And if anything that gets in the way of making music is cut out.
Does that include people?
And that means friends. Uh-huh. Absolutely, it means people. I'll tell you something about people. People are great. But there's people who you get together with and you talk and you go away feeling energized. You feel inspired. And then there's people who you talk with and you go away feeling horrible, feeling drained, feeling like you're incapable of doing anything. Those people are psychic vampires, and I now stay away from them.
Right.
I know what gets in the way, and I know what encourages me to do more work. I used to read reviews, and I would be unable to write a note of music for months at a time because some guy I don't even know who doesn't know me didn't like my work. Now I can look at it and say, well, you didn't like it. There are many people who do.
You've had a kind of famously combative relationship with critics over the years. Is that why? Because it got to you so
much? Because I'm very susceptible to criticism. I'm very sensitive. And, you know, my parents used to say, John, you're oversensitive. And, you know what I can say to them now or what I said back then? I am just the right amount of sensitivity I need to be me. And if you don't like it, take a walk. So, yeah, I mean, I have had a very combative relationship with critics because I'm very impatient with people that don't give my work the respect I feel it deserves.
John Zorn, it's really been great to talk with you. Happy 60th. Thank you for your music.
Thanks, Terry.
John Zorn speaking with Terry Gross. Zorn turned 60 last Monday. His latest album on his record label Zodic is called Dream Machines. You'll find a link to the remaining events in the ongoing Zorn at 60 celebration on our website, freshair.npr.org. The band Superchunk is far from avant-garde, but has been an influential and important force in indie rock since forming in Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1989. In addition to leading the band, singer-songwriter Mac McCann and bassist Laura Balance co-founded Merge Records, which became one of the most successful independent labels ever, with acts including Arcade Fire, Spoon, and The Magnetic Fields. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new Superchunk album.
I hate music, what is it worth, can't bring anyone back to this earth, says Superchunk on its new downbeat but upbeat album. It's the kind of sentiment you imagine someone blurting out with bitter spontaneity. It's not really music the band hates, it is, among other things, a death they're mourning, the despair and grief their music is bearing witness to. The album is dedicated to a close friend who died last year. But more broadly speaking, I Hate Music wants to explore various kinds of loss, of innocence, of youth, of friendships, of passions that struggle and sometimes fail to survive.
Everything the dead don't know piles up like magazines, overflows, and everything that you won't see just swirls around, comes down and buries me. Oh.
Throughout this album, Mac McCann pushes his middle-aged adenoids into ever more plangent tones, even as the guitar work of Jim Wilbur maintains a ferocious denial of the doubt that lurks within most of the lyrics. This creates a sparky tension in the music. The voice sometimes fights against the instruments. At other times, the downer vibe triumphs. And occasionally, as on this song called Low F, they achieve a lovely unity. What will keep us upright, goes a line in that Superchunk song, and the answer, a few lines later, is love, with the typically Superchunkian afterthought, at the risk of sounding obvious. The band need not fret about that. Obviousness is a quality the band has avoided for more than 20 years now. Indeed, this is one of the few bands to have emerged from the early 90s whose work has actually improved as its members have gotten older and wiser. In 2010, after a 9-year gap in Superchunk albums, they released one of their best ever, Majesty Shredding. And there are a number of superlative moments on this new one, including Low F and this wonderfully vivid road song, Trees of Barcelona. The song on I Hate Music is called What Can We Do, which finds Superchunk in one of its periodic quiet moments. It has a lyric about the negativity and pessimism that the band feels surrounding them, even as the pounding drums of John Worster slam out a denial of those sentiments. When joined by the guitars and a soaring vocal, that drum beat becomes a heartbeat, a sign of the enduring health and vigor of Superchunk.
What?
Ken Tucker reviewed Superchunk's new album, I Hate Music. Coming up, John Bradshaw explains why your cat purrs and why the dead mouse it left you wasn't a present. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Cats have come a long way from being dedicated mouse catchers to coddled house pets. This relatively new arrangement is creating new issues for cats and for the people who live with them. Our next guest, John Bradshaw, has studied the history of domesticated cats and how the relationship between people and cats has changed. He's the author of the new book, Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's a follow-up to his book, Dog Sense. He's the foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol in England. As an anthrozoologist, he studies the interactions between people and animals. He's also the former science chair for the International Association of Human-Animal Interaction Organizations. Terry spoke with Bradshaw last Thursday.
John Bradshaw, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me on.
So most of us who live with cats love our cats, and we believe that our cats love us. But some experts disagree and say cats don't really love the humans they live with. What is that controversy about? Why some people don't believe in cat love?
Well, I think cats are much less demonstrative animals than dogs are, and it's kind of not their fault. They evolved from a solitary animal that has never had the need for a kind of sophisticated social repertoire in the way that the dog, having evolved from the wolf, kind of had that ready-made. So their faces are just not terribly expressive, and some people read into that that they're kind of cynical and aloof and all those sorts of things. But I don't believe that for a moment. I think cats show by their behaviour, even if it's a bit more subtle than a dog, that they really are fond of their owners.
But don't some experts say that if a cat's on your lap, it's really seeking warmth, or, you know, that it's like you're bringing the warmth, but it's not like the cat likes you, per se, or it has an affection toward you. It wants you to feed it, it wants your warmth, and that's kind of where it ends. Do you believe that?
I don't think cats are after our warmth particularly. I mean, maybe on a very cold winter's day they might be, but they've got pretty good fur coats of their own. I don't think sitting on a lap is necessarily only good for the warmth aspect. In fact, maybe the opposite. It may actually be that they get too warm. Now, I think they're there in the same way that they would lie up against another member of their own species, another cat that they were particularly friendly with. I think they're there to show that they are our friends and that they're completely relaxed around us.
So when a cat purrs, what do we know about the purr response?
Well, the purr is popularly thought of as being indicating comfort and contentment, and it can be that. But signals like the purr, because it is a signal, it's giving out a message and it's trying to get you to do something. And they don't evolve just to convey emotions, not in the animal world anyway. What we think cats are doing here is essentially just trying to reassure the person or the cat who's hearing the purr that they are no threat and that ideally they would like them to stay still and help them do something. So it starts off with a kitten's purring to get their mothers to lie still while they're suckling, and it goes on into adulthood, and then it can be combined with other sounds. So some cats will have a very kind of loud and slightly uncomfortable purr when they're wanting to be fed. They'll charge around the kitchen making this kind of loud purring noise, which has been named the solicitation purr, and the sound of it is distinct from the regular purr, and it means hang around and feed me. And then there is also a purr that cats will do when they are in deep distress, either very unhappy about something or indeed in pain, and will purr, and, you know, in situations when they're clearly not comfortable or contented. But again, it's a signal to the animals, the people around them, to pay attention and try and help them.
As you point out in your book, cats have made a very rapid evolution from the solitary animal and the animal that catches mice to the beloved pet that sleeps on your pillow. How well do you think cats have adapted to the new kind of role we've given them in our homes?
Well, they've adapted remarkably well, I think. I mean, there are still many cats around the world that are kept for their mousing abilities, their abilities to keep farmyards clear of mice and rats. And then suddenly in the last 50 or 60 years or so, we've started keeping cats in cities. We've started to have our own methods of keeping mice and rats out of cities. We don't need the cat to do it anymore. And so now we've kind of turned around and gone, actually, we'd rather you cats didn't do that. We don't like it when bloody corpses come dragged in through the cat flap. We don't like it when the conservationists say, look, cats are causing a nuisance and maybe even proper damage to wildlife populations. The cats need some time, I think, to catch up.
So what happens when a cat does bring you a bloody corpse, presents it to you as like a little gift that the cat's very proud of? I mean, this just happened to our director, Roberta. She had a little mouse presented to her in the bedroom, and she didn't want to like punish the cat for it. But at the same time, she didn't want to encourage the behavior of, like, dragging a bloody mouse into the bedroom. What should you do in a situation like that?
Well, I think it's to realize that the cat, I don't think, is giving you a present. The cat is merely bringing some prey back to the place it feels safest before it decides whether to eat it or not. And, of course,
oh, really?
In the majority
of cases,
they don't.
Thought it was kind of like you know, thank you. Thank you for taking care of me. And in return,
here's a mouse that I'm actually not going to eat because now I've got it home, I realize it's not very tasty and I'd rather you opened some cat food for me. I think, you know, that tends to be the scenario. So I don't think that the cat is donating the mouse to you in so much as abandoning it as something that it's kind of can't really remember why it killed it in the first place. Well, I think there are a number of things that can be done. None of them are going to be 100% effective, but together they'll go quite a long way. I think the first thing is ensure that if you're getting a kitten, you get a kitten from a place where the mother cat has not gone hunting. So it's not such a good idea to go out and get a kitten off a farm where the mother has brought the kittens up and has already presented them with half-dead mice as a kind of lesson in how to, you know, what's good to eat and how to hunt, because those lessons certainly affect the likelihood that the kitten will grow on to start hunting when it grows up to be a cat itself. You can feed it the best possible food you can. I mean, almost all of the commercially available cat food nowadays is nutritionally adequate, and that's not something that's always been true. I mean, it was only 40, 50 years ago that we actually understood really what a cat's nutritional needs were and how unusual they are. So now we have good quality cat food that should satisfy every cat. They don't need to go hunting. And we do know that cats fed on poor quality or food or scraps or whatever do go hunting a lot more, and they hunt a lot more seriously too, because they really feel this need for the protein that hunting will give them. So good quality food, fit a good quality quick-release collar with a bell on it. That's been shown to have some effect on hunting success. All of those things put together, I think you'll end up with a cat that hunts very little. I mean, the surveys that we've done recently show most pet cats that are well-fed only catch something about once every 2 weeks.
So although you found that some feral cats are actually very sociable to each other, you also say that often humans are fooling themselves when they think, oh, I'm out of the house for a long time every day at work. My cat needs company, so I'm going to get another cat and bring it home as a companion to my cat. And your cat actually might not like the idea of a new cat in the home very much. So can you compare the kind of social adaptation in feral communities with how a solitary cat at home is going to react when a friend cat is brought in?
Feral colonies, first of all, they're natural accumulations of cats. What they're normally based around is one mother cat having kittens in an area where there's plenty of food, and so there's no real incentive for the female kittens particularly to leave. She may drive her male kittens away to prevent inbreeding, but she's often very tolerant to her female kittens, and that's the nucleus of a feral colony. Sometimes unrelated females will try to join. Many times they'll be rejected and chased away. Sometimes they, for some reason, and we don't really know why, they will be accepted. And so you get several females who are not related collaborating and helping one another out. So what you see there in a feral colony is the product of not only just evolution, the evolution of the cat's social abilities, but also a lot of trial and error, cats that don't get on with the group leave, cats that try to join the group and don't get on with them are thrown out, and so on. What we do when we try and add to a household, take one cat and then add another one, is we want that to work first time. And sometimes it does work, in the same way that sometimes an outsider can join a feral colony. But often it doesn't work so well, at least not if the owner doesn't take some precautions and does the whole thing gradually. And there's a well-established way of introducing two cats together. It's not entirely foolproof. It's not guaranteed to work every time. But you can greatly enhance the probability that two cats will get on with one another if, for example, they're introduced to each other's smells, first of all, not literally physically face-to-face, that if you're maybe getting a cat from a shelter, that you take some bedding from the cat's bed in the shelter, take it back to your house, put it in front of your existing cat, let the cat sniff it. It won't take too kindly to it to begin with, but after a day or two, it may get used to it, which is very much how cats learn about other cats. They'll probably smell them before they ever see them in the wild. So this is a very natural way of doing the introduction. And then do the introduction, the physical introduction, when they can actually see one another, with some kind of partition in between, so that if any kind of, one cat does decide to go for the other one, it can't have any nasty effects and certainly no lasting effects on the cats, so that they can get used to one another very gradually. I think where it goes wrong is when people just kind of think, well, these are two cats, they're both cats, they must get along, you know? And usually, or certainly commonly what happens is that the two cats get some sort of stalemate going between them where neither of them really likes the other, but they somehow carve the house up between them. And trouble only starts when, say, there's one litter tray which they have to share, which they won't like at all, or there's only one food bowl which they have to essentially compete over. So for people who've got two cats already who might not seem to be getting along too well, if you just allow them, give them two of everything, and they'll sort it out between themselves 9 times out of 10.
How many cats have you had at the same time?
I've had about 6 or 7 at the same time, including kittens. But they've all been, I've basically, for most of my life, had one family of cats. So that they've, all the kittens, all the younger cats, had grown up with the older cats. And that's mimicking, if you like, the feral situation where kittens grow up in an environment where most of the adult cats are already getting along together. And so they take their cue from that. That's the way they start behaving themselves.
So ideally, if you want two cats, should you get two cats from the same litter?
Ideally, yes, but it doesn't always work. I mean, I have to say, I've got friends who've gone out and done that. 8 times out of 10, probably it does work, but sometimes for some reason the two decide they don't like each other. Cats are unpredictable. I mean, I think maybe that's part of their charm, but unlike with dogs, there's kind of no rules.
I think one of the issues you have to face if you're getting a kitten is whether you're going to have that kitten declawed or not. And that's become increasingly controversial. So let's start with a description of what actually happens when a cat is declawed.
Well, the operation involves essentially taking the ends of, what we would call our fingers off. And I have a very kind of personal experience of this. I had the end of one of my fingers crushed in an accident many, many years ago. And for years afterwards, it was restored to some extent by the surgeons, but not completely. And for many years afterwards, I got phantom pains in that finger, which I knew, I'm a human being and I could look at my finger and go, I know that's a phantom pain. I know it's not real pain. It's annoying and it's distracting, but I can live with it. I think, people, war veterans who have whole legs injured or amputated in that way, it's a much more serious problem. But I think if I'd had 8 of those, then, and I was a cat and couldn't really understand what had happened to me, I suspect I would have not been happy about it.
Until I read your book, I never thought of the possibility that cats would have phantom pain in the part of the paw that was amputated during the declawing process. I never used to think of declawing as amputation. I thought of it as taking the nails out.
Yeah, no, surgically it's more than that, because you have to take out the whole bit where the claw grows from rather than just the claw itself. And cats will lose claws and regrow them quite easily. It's a natural thing that they have evolved in order to be able to keep hunting, even if they damage a claw. So there is that possibility, and I think there is some evidence that this may actually, from veterinarians, that this may actually be the case. But there's an ethical issue as well, I suspect, which is reflected in the codes of practice over here in Europe, where declawing is illegal. I mean,
veterinarians, it's illegal in Europe, really?
Yeah. Yeah, they're not allowed to do it. It's regarded as being a mutilation of the animal.
But here's the thing. Let me give you an example of my neighbor who got this adorable little kitten a couple of years ago. And the kitten, she wasn't sure whether she'd have the kitten declawed or not. But after a while, the kitten would lay in bed with her and would paw her face a lot, affectionately, but still, this young woman was afraid that the kitten was going to accidentally claw her eye or seriously scratch her face. And at that point, she decided, just for my own safety, I love this kitten, but I need to get it declawed. And I so completely understand that. What would you say about that?
Well, the use of the claws in a social context, as you're describing, is something that mother cats teach their kittens not to do. I mean, kittens, as they grow up, will play roughly with one another. They'll quite quickly find that if they play roughly with their claws out with an adult cat, that they get a swipe round the head and they don't do it again, or at least after a couple of times, I don't do it again. When things like that have happened to me, I have just imitated a cat, which is to do a dry spit, if you like, if that's...
You spit at your cat?
I don't actually spit, but you make the noise that mother cats do when they're telling their kittens off, and cats really take notice of that, and they'll tend not to do it again. They understand
that. Do it again
signal.
So I can get what you're doing.
You can just go... at the cat. So you're not actually spitting at the cat, but you're making a spitting noise which imitates what the mother cat does, and that will dissuade the cat. If that's not enough, a carefully aimed water pistol is a great way of persuading a cat not to do something, provided you catch it in the act. I mean, like all kinds of animal training, if you're going to produce a nasty stimulus, whether it's a noise the cat doesn't like or a brief jet of water, the only way it will work is if the cat is actually doing the thing that you don't want it to do when the punishment arrives. If you do it afterwards, the cat won't understand.
Well, how can you explain to the cat that it's the claws that's the issue and not the proximity of the cat? That it's one very specific part of the action, the claws.
By only doing it when the claws are out. And as I say, my experience has been that because mother cats, it's something that kittens kind of almost expect mother cats to be training them to do. I've never had a problem with cats scratching me like that, and I think that's part of the reason. The other reason, of course, is that many of my cats have grown up, been born in my house, and so their mothers have done the training for me. And it is more common, that kind of behaviour is more common in kittens that are taken away from their mothers too young. At 6 or 7 weeks, so a little bit later, leave them a little bit later, and the mother will do the job.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me on.
John Bradshaw speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. Bradshaw is the author of the new book, Cat Sense. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shirock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media and updates our blog, where right now, producers Anne-Marie and Lauren are posting behind-the-scenes dispatches from the Toronto International Film Festival. It's on our blog at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.